Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and it is my last All Things Political this hour. We have a lot to talk about with Ruth Conniff from The Progressive and Jonathan Allen from Sidewire and Roll Call, author of Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has assembled a team of lawyers with expertise in cybercrime, white-collar crime, the mob, money laundering, and Watergate, and he has pretty wide latitude to examine whatever he would like to examine. There's now a grand jury, and it's based in D.C. It can subpoena witnesses and documents and could indict people. Would a grand jury be impaneled if there were no evidentiary basis to move forward? This appears to be a very serious investigation, but we don't know what's being investigated, nor will we know its conclusion for probably quite some time. An explosive, shattered windows in a room at the Islamic Center outside Minneapolis early Saturday morning. Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton calls this a dastardly, cowardly hate crime and an act of terrorism. Chicago's mayor is suing the Justice Department for threatening to withhold law enforcement grants due to Chicago's status as a sanctuary city. An article in the Washington Post headlines, Democrats are moving left, and that won't necessarily hurt them in 2018. What do the Democrats stand for now? New York Times reported over the weekend, Mike Pence's schedule is so full of political events that Republicans joke he is acting more like a second-term vice president helping to clear the field than a number two sworn in a little over 6 months ago. Pence said the article was disgraceful. On Meet the Press yesterday, Senator Jeff Flake said that some people, but not enough, stood up to birtherism charges. Governor Scott Walker says the Foxconn move here is a transformational one, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Wisconsin. We will particularly ask Ruth about that. And because it's the last All Things Political, a momentous occasion, I hope we'll get a lot of phone calls about politics this hour. This also marks the 200th day of the Trump presidency. Our phone number, here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Ruth Conniff has joined us many times before. She is editor of the Progressive Magazine, vice president of the Progressive Inc., and she is a native of Wisconsin. At the end of this week, we'll ask her about this toward the end of the show. She is moving her family over the wall to Mexico. We'll talk about that. Thanks, Ruth, so much for being with us again.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen. I'm so glad to make the last All Things Political. I can't believe it.
I know. I'm going to miss this show. I love doing this show.
Yeah.
Jonathan Allen is also with us, head of community and content for Sidewire. He's a columnist for Roll Call, author of the New York Times best-selling Clinton biography, HRC, and most recently, and the last time we interviewed him, co-author of the book Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Jonathan, a pleasure always to speak with you. Hi.
Kathleen, it's an honor to be with you on this last episode.
Thanks, Jonathan. So good to have both of you. Well, let's start with this whole grand jury that has been impaneled in Washington, D.C. And we have now these lawyers. Just tell me what this means. Expertise in cybercrime, white-collar crime, the mob, money laundering, and Watergate. Where is this investigation going? Ruth?
Well, it's going a lot of places, apparently. You know, I mean, that's the thing about these sorts of investigations. I was actually listening to Rush Limbaugh in the car on the way over, and it's interesting to listen to the conservative perspective on this. There's a real effort to say that it wouldn't be legal and it wouldn't be proper for Mueller to go down various roads that are outside the purview of the original reason for launching the investigation. But, of course, that's not the history of these investigations. If you remember the Clinton Lewinsky scandal, that started with an investigation of Whitewater,
right,
a real estate deal by Ken Starr, and ended up with Monica Lewinsky in a blue dress. So, you know, there are a lot of different places that Mueller has the power to go. And if you look at the list of issues that he's investigating, a lot of it just points back to the corrupt kleptocracy in Russia, the ties between the government of Russia and organized crime, the cyber attacks that they've launched around the globe, including in our last election, you know, the money laundering and the potential business ties between close people close to Donald Trump and Russia, the Russian government and Russian oligarchs. So there's a whole lot that could come out there, and we won't know a whole lot about it for a while because, of course, it's a secret grand jury investigation.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, is it a big deal for there to be a grand jury now impaneled? Does it mean that this is more serious and that there will be moving forward in a more rapid fashion?
I don't think it's surprising. Number one, there was already a grand jury working in Northern Virginia, so now there's a second grand jury, and I think that's simply more convenient in the District of Columbia for Mueller and his team. But I think we're at a point now where it's very clear that this is going to be a thorough investigation. And if you were the president and you believe you've done nothing wrong, you would think that you would welcome a very thorough investigation would then give you sort of the gold seal of approval that you've done nothing wrong, or at least you would play it that way while the investigation was going through. But as has just been pointed out, I mean, you've got a Republican Party right now in a White House that are intent on trying to say there are certain things that are outside the scope of the special prosecutor here, which would be new.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there's something outside the scope. And of course, a possible predicate for the president to order the firing of the special prosecutor. That said, I don't see that happening. I think that's the point at which Congress would turn on him.
Well, what are they doing legislatively? Aren't they doing something to keep that from happening?
There are several proposals, actually, to try to prevent Trump from being able to fire Mueller. I think both on the Republican and the Democratic side, people are really worried about, first of all, the parallels with the Nixon administration. On the Republican side, it is just really disreputable and was really what triggered ultimately Nixon's resignation, his firing of Archibald Cox. But in addition, you know, on the Democratic side, you have people like Cory Booker who are saying we got to make sure that we proactively protect the special prosecutor here.
Mm-hmm.
The key difference between the Nixon White House era and the current Trump administration era is that in the Nixon case, you had you had an attorney general and the deputy attorney general who resigned rather than getting rid of the special prosecutor. In this case, you've got Jeff Sessions and below him Rod Rosenstein, who actually were complicit in the firing of the FBI director Jim Comey, who was attempting to do this investigation in the first place. Now, Rosenstein seems to have pivoted a little bit and seems to be interested in protecting his reputation. So he may have had it up to his ears with Trump pretty quickly. But, Jeff Sessions, certainly the attorney general here, fired the guy investigating the president, as opposed to in the Nixon days where there were resignations from people who preferred not to do that during the Saturday Night Massacre.
Mm-hmm. What does this tweet from the president mean? Last Thursday, he tweets that it's the fault of Congress that our relationship with Russia is at an all-time and very dangerous low. So he's blaming Congress, and he's not blaming Russia for what they did to our election and probably plan to do again. Isn't that a strange tweet? What's going on with him in Russia?
Well, Donald Trump did not want to impose sanctions on Russia and really, you know, has really dragged his feet on that and obviously has had at least up till now, a very positive relationship with Putin. So I think he's just trying to say that the fact that we're reaching, you know, sort of a new level of Cold War-like hostility with the dismissal of U.S. diplomats in Russia, the turning back of U.S. Various U.S. facilities and diplomatic positions there, that's not his fault. That he always said that it was a good idea to have a good relationship with the world's other superpower, and he clearly hasn't wanted to pursue this.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan.
Yeah, it's interesting here with Trump and Russia that, A, he has essentially the same talking point about the sanctions as the Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, who said that Trump had been humiliated by Congress seizing his authority over the sanctions. That's basically what Trump said, too, that Congress had overstepped his bounds. He said it certainly in his signing statement where he said that the Congress had violated its boundaries, and then also in terms of talking about the bad relationship with Russia. one of the allegations that Trump's opponents have against him is that Russia has so much leverage over him or so much influence with him that it's affecting American foreign policy and making him do things that are in Russia's interest. And what's interesting is it's not clear whether, you know, it's that potential leverage that somebody has or simply that Trump believes Russia is a good ally for the United States, because that's also his foreign policy position. And at some level, it gets to the point where it doesn't really matter anymore whether it's the leverage or whether it's his policy view. It is very far outside the mainstream of American foreign policy thought.
Mm-hmm. So all of this is kind of interesting. Mike Pence really says this is a disgraceful article, but the New York Times reporting over the weekend that his schedule is so full of political events that Republicans joke that he's acting more like a second-term vice president helping to clear the field than number two sworn in about 6 months ago. He's got his own political fundraising committee, Great America Committee. He's raising money. He's all over the country on this. What's going on, Ruth?
I mean, there's a lot of palace intrigue in the Trump administration, and I think the efforts to shut down leaks and leakers will not likely succeed in squashing that altogether. But from the very beginning, Mike Pence, in becoming Trump's running mate, was sort of the, you know, the conservative movement guy who was in the Trump administration to reassure particularly evangelical Christians that somebody that they could relate to was involved with this administration. And with his long history in government, somebody who actually knows something about how government works was reassuring to the establishment folks in Washington in this very strange new era. And there's no doubt that Mike Pence is extremely ambitious. And he, like everybody in the Trump administration, speaks publicly directly to Donald Trump himself to quash rumors and try to say that, you know, he's on the team. But the fundraising really speaks for itself. I mean, it's really unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean, Jonathan? Are there a lot of people in Washington saying that they don't think Trump will make it to second term?
That's the parlor game here.
Is it?
Certainly, oh yeah, people lay odds on it all the time.
Really?
The likelihood that Donald Trump is on the ballot in 2020. Sure, because there are multiple scenarios that you could see him. He could simply get bored and decide he doesn't want to run again. He could be removed from office through an impeachment. He could resign in the face of potential impeachment proceedings, depending on where the special counsel goes and depending on what Congress sees. So there are a lot of scenarios that are discussed a lot. I think we're a long way from any of those, but there are a lot of scenarios discussed a lot in which Donald Trump wouldn't be on the ballot. Mike Pence can't run against Donald Trump. I mean, he's not going to run a primary against against the sitting president. So the question is, what is he doing for 2020? And I think the answer is that all of the things that you would do to prepare to run for vice president again are the same as you would do to prepare to run for president in the event that the current president wasn't on the ballot. I think that the Times is right to point out that Pence is doing all of this, and I think there are a lot of Republicans, particularly those who aren't pleased with Pence, who want to see his moves in the light of being disloyal to the president and certainly want that storyline out there. But I don't believe that Mike Pence holding political meetings and raising money for 2020 mean that he's disloyal. I mean, if he is vice president and running for vice president again, all of that stuff goes to the benefit of Donald Trump. And if for some reason Donald Trump is not on the ballot again, then Mike Pence is putting himself in a position to you know, sort of take over the team.
Hmm. It's a peculiar administration, though, in that it has launched its next campaign moments after taking office, and while not filling positions, you know, throughout the federal government, where we're, you know, running a State Department that doesn't have any staff. I mean, it's really kind of wild that the vice president, who could play a key role in helping to organize things in the White House, is, like Donald Trump himself, involved in campaign-oriented activities, and the administration itself seems to be falling apart.
Mm. Yeah, there's pure. I mean, this is a purely political operation. The Trump Pence is a. I mean, Mike Pence has some policy interests and policy ideas. He's not, he's not without those. He's kind of an ideologue. But in terms of Trump world, it's all about the politics. There's, I mean, other than the wall that he wants to build between the United States and Mexico, there's very little in which Trump seems to really care about policy-wise.
And before we move on to the Democrats, he has a book out, but he's been very outspoken. Senator Jeff Flake on Meet the Press yesterday. This has been an issue that's always been of concern to me, and tell me why it lasted so long and who believed this and why he carried on with this. And if it would have made a difference if Republicans had stood up to him. He said that some people, but not enough people, Republicans, he's saying, stood up to these birtherism charges that Donald Trump persisted in talking about for something like 7 years. Would it have been different? Were there not many Republicans who stood up and said, this is just not right, this is goofy, why are you doing this?
Would it not have taken hold?
Yeah, would it not have taken hold? Would he have stopped it after he said it the first time?
I mean, I think that the birther charge was really a way of talking about Obama's race. Mm. And so it was part of a kind of parallel universe that has grown and consolidated itself with the, you know, siloing of media and people who read Breitbart and listen to Rush Limbaugh and watch Fox News, sort of living in their own reality where it's possible that the President of the United States wasn't born here. There's all kinds of kind of peculiar conspiracy theories that have thrived there, and people who peddle them have moved right into top-level administration positions now with the Trump administration. But the political impact of that, I think, had to do with pointing out that Obama was black, that he was the first black president, and the suggestion that he was born in Kenya was a way of talking about that over and over and trying to gin up a really ugly racist sentiment in the country. And I think the other thing that has happened, and I think there's a combination of that kind of right-wing populist appeal to racism and blaming black and brown people for economic insecurity among working-class whites. And then there's the sort of reality TV, anything-goes, fact-free media environment, which has grown up simultaneously. And Trump just very successfully combined those forces. And it's a strange, chaotic, different kind of world that we're living in with those combined forces, and it's not a normal political world. So I'm not sure that Jeff Flake is right that a couple of U.S. senators could have turned the tide there. I think that the danger there is that over many, many years, as you know, the rise of Fox News was really the first big force in this, there is this sort of parallel political and news and entertainment infrastructure that makes it hard to find a consensus, fact-based reality from which to, you know, talk to people about politics. Mm.
You agree with that take, Jonathan?
I'm not sure that I do entirely. I think that it's important to remember that with the birtherism, there was a lot of grassroots activity on that. That this was not something that, while Donald Trump was stirring it up and others were stirring it up, this was not something that was really being pushed by elected leaders. It was really going on at the grassroots level, and then elected leaders would get asked about it, and they would not just simply stand up and, as Jeff Flake suggested, they didn't stand up and say, no, Barack Obama was born in the United States. He's legitimately elected president. My view is that that the American public looks to people in positions of authority, people in positions who have platforms and megaphones, and takes cues from what they're doing. And I think if the Republican senators and Republican House members and Republican governors across the country had all said, no, this, you know, it's crazy to say Barack Obama wasn't born here, instead of trying to take advantage of it for politics, that might have sent a strong signal to even those who were simply using it, as cover for sort of a racist view of Obama. I think that would have been quieted down. Instead, it was allowed to fester. When even when you choose not to shout it down, you're tacitly encouraging it to continue. So I think it would have made a difference. It's hard to know exactly how much of a difference, but there were not many profiles in courage on that front.
We'll talk about the Democrats as we continue. Are they moving left? Will that hurt them or will that help them? What is the Democratic position on a number of issues? This is All Things Political, my last All Things Political, so let's wrap it all up here today. What do you think about where this presidency is, what the future is for the country, and all of the issues, and really lack of success in moving legislation along with his presidency. What do you think about the Russia investigation? What do you think about statements on immigration, cutting it in half? What do you think about sanctuary cities? We'll talk about that as well. So a lot more to discuss. Also, what happened in Minnesota, the bombing of a mosque outside Minneapolis. And there have been many more instances of anti-Muslim hate going on in this country. Do we need to address that? Why are we not addressing this more forcefully? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We have two guests with us for all things political. Ruth Conniff, who is editor of the Progressive magazine. Jonathan Allen, head of community and content for Sidewire. He's a columnist for Roll Call as well, and is author most recently of Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network. All Things Political, let's hear from you as we wrap up All Things Political. 800-486-8655 is our number. John in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I've got a couple questions with concerning the Russian-American situation. One, I understand in 96 we interfered with the nation's democratic process in Russia with the election. Yeltsin, U.S. help, I understand he wouldn't have gotten in. He only had 8% in the polls going into that election. And if this is true, it seems like it's tit for tat or reciprocity on the part of Putin getting involved in our electoral process. Secondly, I really do not understand why we have a new containment program going towards Russia. We were left with mutual assured destruction at the end of the Cold War. That country, the capitalist country now, it can still destroy us, and yet we're engaging in this brinkmanship with Russia, you know, extending a NATO process through all the Eastern European countries, which we promised Gorbachev we wouldn't, and we've been stirring up trouble not only in Georgia but also the Ukraine. You know, we gave approval to a provincial government containing Yanukovych, and then we immediately okayed the coup, the right-wing coup that took over. The key thing, issue to me is they're still capable of destroying us. Why are we antagonizing them?
Jonathan, why don't you start?
Well, number one, I would say the question of whether we interfere in other countries' elections, number one, we have done that in the past. But number two, I think there's a difference between the effort to interfere in another country's election, say Russia perhaps interfering in our election this time, and one of the candidates in the country being interfered with, potentially colluding with that foreign power. Those are sort of different issues. And so I think the investigation into the extent to which the Trump campaign had contact with Russia and potentially colluded with Russia is worthwhile for us to look at on a domestic basis. In terms of the other thing I would note is I'm not sure in foreign policy we want to it's in the best interest of the United States to always look at what other countries are doing or not doing and saying we should have one standard for everything. I mean, I think just from a practical standpoint, it's reasonable to have for a country to have a double standard on certain things. And then the third thing that I would just note on that is we may be antagonizing Russia, but they are also antagonizing us. And there is a sort of broad agreement in the foreign policy establishment that allowing Russia to gain more territory and to become stronger is not in the best interest of the United States. Now, Donald Trump ran with a different foreign policy than what the foreign policy establishment says, and that he, you know, I think rightfully believes that he's got the right to push that and try to see what he can do to change our relationship with Russia and our relationships with very many other countries. It is just at odds with what our longstanding foreign policy has been.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's hard to say if we are too antagonistic towards Russia now or if we are too blasé about the idea of our president colluding with Russia to interfere with the democratic process within our country, which is a truly astounding proposition. And it is, I mean, I'm sympathetic to people who point out that the United States has interfered in elections abroad. And I think, you know, Ariel Dorfman from Chile wrote about this really winningly in the New York Times when he talked about, you know, imagine a foreign power intervening in a democratic election. I can see it, you know, because, of course, the CIA helped put down Allende in Chile. And he was part of that. He was there for that. He witnessed the, you know, the replacement of a democratically elected leader with U.S. help in Chile with a pretty brutal regime. So that happened. But here in the United States, as citizens of the United States, I think we can both hold our country to a higher ideal, our democracy to a higher ideal, care about human rights around the globe, and care here domestically about our own democracy, as opposed to just giving way to complete and total cynicism, which is really what has happened to people in Russia. There's just a level of cynicism about believing anything the government says, about Putin's involvement in the murder of Russian citizens and blaming that on Chechen rebels, which turns out to be completely incredible. You know, that's a really scary reality. And the fact that Donald Trump both rhetorically embraces Putin as a strong man and that members of the Trump administration have potentially been involved in Russian meddling in our election should really concern anybody who cares about American democracy.
Let's move on to the Democrats for a moment. Midterms aren't that far away. There was a piece in the Post over the weekend that Democrats are moving left, and that won't necessarily hurt them. The better deal is built on the $15 an hour minimum wage, $1 trillion in deficit-financed infrastructure spending, and agencies that could cancel lopsided free trade deals. Are, Jonathan, the Democrats all in on that better deal? And what do you think? Does it help the party in terms of midterm and 2020 election to move left?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think if you look at the Democratic platform from the 2016 campaign, it had moved significantly left. I think Hillary Clinton as a general election candidate was to the left of where Barack Obama had been in 12 and in 2008. So I'm not sure how far left the sort of new proposals are as compared to the 16 platform which had been sort of a compromise between the Clinton and Sanders campaigns. That said, I don't think Democrats are all on board. I think Democrats are pretty lost right now. I think they are arguing with each other over whether the last election means that they should move left, a view held by people on the left, or whether they should move to the center, a view held by people who have long been in the center. And there's not really a leader right now that they have coalesced behind that can sort of guide that process. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that'll emerge until they've got a nominee for 2020.
Ruth?
Well, I think if you live in Wisconsin, you have to see that the Democratic Party has not successfully appealed to voters in a state that traditionally went blue in every presidential year since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
And that, you know, has a really long progressive tradition that, you know, predates FDR, actually, the Better Deal, echoing the New Deal, which is sort of the last big popular program that the Democrats put forward. So absolutely, the Democratic Party needs to think about how to recapture the group of people that were called the Reagan Democrats, the working class folks in Wisconsin and elsewhere who voted for Trump in this last election, and to think about what it is that's causing the disconnect that is the perception among a whole lot of voters who are really worried about their future, that the Democrats don't really care, that they're the party of Wall Street and Hollywood and not the party of the New Deal and the really bracing rhetoric of FDR about challenging the banks and, inviting the enmity of Wall Street and standing up for people. So, I mean, I think to the extent that the Democrats are trying to figure out how to get that across, it makes a lot of sense. And in our state, which was a big Bernie Sanders state in the primary and then went for Donald Trump in the general election, you can see that something has to change and that talking to people about their immediate needs, whether it's crushing college debt for a generation of students and their parents who are really worried about that, or the flight of manufacturing and the real concern that between automation and lopsided trade deals, people are simply not going to have the kinds of jobs that sustained whole communities, high-quality public schools, and the privatization of schools that's rampant here and elsewhere in communities that used to have fantastic, well-funded public schools. I mean, all of these things are things that Democrats need to get a handle on and talk in a clear way about how they have a better vision and not this dystopian vision that really pretty much sells anger and resentment and not much of a solution. I think there's a real opportunity for the Democrats to say something better and do something better.
Jonathan, do you think there's anybody we should keep our eyes on who might be a rising star?
There might be two dozen. It reminds me a little bit of the Republican primary field of 2016, where you see like a whole bunch of people that aren't quite there yet. Kamala Harris, the California senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, the New York senator, Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, all people that have been talked about running. Elizabeth Warren's looking at it, Bernie Sanders again, Joe Biden. I wouldn't categorize any of the last three as rising stars. they're at the older end of the baby boomer or older in the case of Sanders and Biden. Tim Ryan, congressman from Ohio, is somebody people are talking about as potentially running for president. We haven't seen a lot of House members run for president. In fact, James Garfield was the only one who ever won the presidency directly from the House. But basically any elected Democrat right now is looking at running for president. And there are a couple of people who are sort of on the other side interesting, I think, basically Democrats who come from Republican states. Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans and former lieutenant governor of Louisiana, and I should mention my wife used to work for his sister in the Senate, just by way of disclosure. Jason Kander, who lost a Missouri Senate race last time but had a really memorable ad where he was assembling a rifle blindfolded. Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. There are a whole number of Democrats who are from Republican states that wouldn't normally be thought of because they haven't won a governorship or are not sitting in the United States Senate, but might also be capable of expanding and advertising better to Republican voters or independent voters.
Let's go to Scott in Dodgeville. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm calling to say that the Democrats must move towards the Sanders progressives in the party, and they need to start doing it now. They lost not because of what the Russians didn't do. They lost because they disrespected Sanders. They didn't either name him as vice president or name someone from the progressive movement that has allied with Sanders as a vice president candidate. That was absolute disrespect shown by the center-right mainstream of the Democratic Party. And if they don't move from that, they're not going to win again.
Ruth.
Well, I think that there's something to be said for just noticing where the energy is in the primary. And if you went to the Democratic convention, you noticed all these very young, very idealistic Sanders delegates who were shocked by the way the party does its business. And it wasn't shocking to people who'd been to convention after convention because, you know, the center of power and money was with the Hillary Clinton folks. But some of the things that happened there were not just about, you know, who got to introduce Sanders or didn't, and, you know, when he got to speak, and, you know, whether they really got their chance to have a floor vote for him. They were really about issues. So there was a big pro-fracking contingent at the Democratic convention, and when anti-fracking delegates stood up to hold up their anti-fracking signs, they were shouted down with chants of USA, USA. There were some really jarring disconnect moments like that where the energy of the younger delegates was with Sanders, and the energy of, you know, just a deep commitment to doing something about climate change, to really caring about economic inequality, all of those issues that really drive people to care about politics and get off the couch and vote. That was all with the Sanders delegation. And so it just didn't turn out to be a huge surprise that there wasn't a ton of energy for Hillary Clinton, and that a lot of the reason she lost was just that people didn't come out and vote for her who should have been voting for the Democrat in a general election. And I think that's really the message.
And as we speak with the guy who wrote the book about why she lost, why do you want to add to that, Jonathan? Why did she lose?
Well, look, I think Bernie Sanders and his contingent certainly did a lot of damage to her, and I think that the frustration that she was seen as sort of a pale imitation of a Republican by a lot of the progressives did her a lot of damage. I think the email scandal hit her honesty. I believe her lack of a message about what she was going to do for people rather than what she would do for herself in running for president. I mean, I think there were a lot of reasons that she was in a position to lose to Donald Trump. But specifically at the, interestingly, at the convention, the Chants of USA and, you know, sort of pro-Clinton, pro-party placards going up in front of protesters, all of that was arranged with the help of the Bernie Sanders campaign. There was a secret text messaging system going back and forth between Clinton operatives and the top operatives for Bernie Sanders, who were trying to keep the convention under control together, which is interesting, and I'm sure probably didn't make some of the more dead-end Sanders folks happy. But I think what some folks who wanted Bernie Sanders are finding with the Trump administration is that if they were, for instance, concerned about climate change, they're now finding that there's going to be coal mining on federal land that was not pre-existing.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I'm not sure that they necessarily served their purpose by staying home or even voting for Trump.
But it doesn't matter that you're smarter than the voters, because if they don't vote for you, the fact that you're smarter and you have a realistic kind of compromise position that they ought to buy doesn't make them come out and elect you. So it doesn't matter.
I totally agree with you. I don't disagree with you at all. I think the Democrats have, particularly Hillary Clinton, but the Democrats more broadly have failed to connect with voters on the issues that the voters care about and to communicate with voters in the way that voters are communicating. I thought Bill Clinton was a lot better about that on the campaign trail than Hillary Clinton was, and every time he opened his mouth and said something like Obamacare is the craziest thing as an opener to get people to want to change it just a little bit, he got his hand slapped. So, I completely agree with you. You've got to be able to talk to voters.
And there is
Hillary
a culture.
Clinton was not able to do that.
I think in both our state party here and other state parties and also in the National Democratic Party, there is a culture of disconnect from those grassroots activists and a contempt, really. And so, you know, that's just not a winning approach. You know, I remember in the Al Gore campaign, same thing. You know, we had people come to Wisconsin and browbeat us about how we needed to vote for Al Gore even if we were unenthusiastic. And indeed, it would have been better to have a Gore presidency than a Bush presidency. But just like in the Hillary Clinton campaign, you know, you had a lot of young people who were never going to come out because they were scolded into it. And meanwhile, we have this sort of slow slide on a policy level for a lot of people who are really worried about their future. So I think if they can't get the message now, the Democrats are hopeless. Like, you can't regroup and say to yourself, well, now they're getting their comeuppance, and next time they'll vote for our pallid corporate candidate.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. It's All Things Political, the final one I'll be doing, so we're welcoming your phone calls. We need to move on to a few other issues as well, but feel free to comment on whatever political news is stirring in your mind this week. We have two guests with us, Jonathan Allen, who is the head of community and content for Sidewire. He's a columnist for Roll Call, and he's the author of the Times bestseller Shattered, Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign, and also the New York Times bestselling Clinton biography, HRC. Ruth Conniff is also with us, Vice President of the Progressive, editor of the Progressive magazine. And at the end of this week, we have to talk about this. She's moving her family over the wall to Mexico. We'll talk about that as well. Here's our number. Join us. It's the last one of these we have. Where do we stand as a country? Where are we politically? What are you worried about? What are you happy about? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. Todd from Delavan sends this email. Does Trump really believe, naively so, that coal and steel jobs can and will come back, or is he just continuing his campaign rhetoric appealing to his base? Jonathan, you mentioned coal. How do you respond to Todd?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to know what somebody really believes, but there's no reason to think that Trump doesn't believe that he can bring back steel and coal jobs. I'm not sure that he's necessarily an expert on those parts of the economy, but he's been true to that campaign promise, and he's been doing what he can to try to encourage companies to invest in industries that the government had been discouraging for a long time.
Let's, before we go back to many phone calls coming in, talk about this bombing that took place at the Dalar Farouk Islamic Center in suburban Minneapolis. Shattered windows, the explosion shattered a room. right before the 5 a.m. service. And this was a center that served mostly the Somali community. But we've also heard about these anti-Muslim incidents in the country having been increased. We have more vandalism at mosques, harassment of women who are wearing head coverings, bullying of school children. There was a somewhat publicized incident at an Islamic cemetery that was vandalized. Why isn't there, and there is very little addressing of this horror from Washington, D.C. Why not? This is not good. This is horrible.
It is really terrible, and it is an example of how the tone of the administration really can make a difference. And, you know, we talked about this earlier, about whether Jeff Flake was right that birtherism could have been stopped by a few politicians being braver. And, you know, and Jonathan and I sort of disagreed about what a difference that would make. But I agree that, in this case particularly, you have an administration that has over and over again demonized an entire group of people. And it's a terrible time to be a Muslim American and to deal with the level of hate that's been ratcheted up from the highest levels in the United States. And the counterweight to that, I think, is that a lot of people have been activated to try to defend their Muslim neighbors and to really empathize with how unfair it is to scapegoat Muslims. And I think that's really important, that just as ordinary citizens, we think about what we can do to take down the temperature and to promote tolerance and make life better for people, because it's a scary time for them.
Yeah, it really is an act of terrorism, Jonathan, isn't it?
Yes. And I think we need to find out more about this particular incident and a lot of other incidents. But I would just associate myself with what Ruth just said. I think she's absolutely right in terms of the tone in Washington. Mm-hmm. And, you've got a president who has, at the very least, been very tolerant of intolerance, and in some cases been more than that. So, I think back to George W. Bush, who, even when going to war in multiple Muslim nations, kept pounding on the idea that America was not at war with Islam, and trying to make the point that there were a lot of partners in the Muslim world for the United States. And there have been, on a variety of issues, ranging from anti-terrorism to the campaign in Libya and various other things. So, like I said, I would just associate with what Ruth said.
Margie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for this show. And my first gut reaction is that Democrats aren't going to win until they learn how to talk to people in a different way. Trump came out and talked differently, and it caught people's attention. Now, it seemed to matter that he talked to our base, the lowest part of ourselves, the worst part of ourselves, as opposed to somebody like Kennedy, who used to talk to our higher being. And he instilled faith and hope and wanting to go out and do things Peace Corps. He mobilized the whole generation. Trump seems to be going in the other way. And I think that I felt like Hillary was going to lose when she named Tim Kaine, not because he wasn't a great man and could be a great candidate, but he didn't have a resounding message, and he looked kind of blasé to everybody. He didn't come out. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie, they were angry and in your face, but they had different messages. They told us why we should be mad about something, and they didn't use all the rhetoric kind of stuff that makes our eyes gloss over. Everybody sounds the same because they're afraid to say something wrong, so they stick to this stupid script. And the thing with Elizabeth Warren, they get mad at her. People don't like her because she's an angry woman. Bernie can be an angry man, and he's respected, but Elizabeth Warren, McConnell has treated her like dirt, just simply because she's an angry woman on the floor. And it just burns me. And McConnell and Boehner, they never took a stand. And they own this Trump fiasco because they let it brew and simmer and boil over.
Thanks, Margie, for your call. Jonathan.
My co-author Amy Parnes and I write in Shattered about a late run that Elizabeth Warren had at the vice presidential slot. Hillary Clinton was unsatisfied with her potential choices, including Kaine. She wanted somebody more interesting. Ultimately decided that she couldn't entirely trust that Warren would be on her side in governing, you know, because the White House, the Obama White House, had some issues with Warren, and it ended up not going that direction. But there was a huge push inside the campaign for somebody that was more progressive than Tim Kaine. There were a lot of people who went to her and said that she should go with Warren or perhaps Sherrod Brown of Ohio, the senator there. They decided against him because John Kasich would have been able to appoint a replacement. A lot of the considerations had to do with a governing partner rather than winning the election. And my guess is if they had to go back and do it again, they might point more toward what would help her win the election.
Interesting. Liz, we have a number of different issues, and I want to get some calls. We're running out of time. The attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act, is it over, Ruth?
Well, they're never going to be done talking about it and running on it and attacking it. And they may undermine it. I mean, that's the fear now. I mean, the failure to repeal and replace Obamacare is heartening. It's a pretty dramatic last failure. But the worry is that they will disrupt the market so much that they will create a reality in which what they say, which is that people don't like the Affordable Care Act, which is not really true of for the people who benefit from it, will become true because they'll try to make it impossible for it to function.
The action taken by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Jonathan, the city sued, the plans are in motion now, the Justice Department for threatening to withhold law enforcement grants due to their status as a sanctuary city. I would imagine there might be some other cities who will join that suit, do you think?
I imagine so. It's interesting. Democrats are now the party of states' rights, or in this case, cities' rights, where they're basically saying the federal government doesn't have the authority to impose national standards on the immigration law. It's not where the Democrats were, you know, at least the liberal Democrats were, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But they are making that argument now. And it's just a matter of using whatever leverage you have to try to get the policy that you want. And I think that's what the federal government is doing with the threat to withhold grants. And it's what the local governments are doing, fighting back on the sanctuary cities.
Quick question on North Korea. Alan in Madison.
Yes. Can you explain to me how the United States and other nuclear powers have the moral authority to dictate to other countries like North Korea and Iran that they shouldn't have any nuclear weapons while we keep on upgrading our nuclear arsenals and our missile technology?
Ruth.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know if you can say that one country has the moral authority, but it is an existential necessity, I think, that the world worry quite a bit about North Korea's nuclear weapons. And you know, it is a great fear that, you know, on the one hand, we're not doing a whole lot to prevent the progress that North Korea has made while haplessly and over a long period of time steadily towards actually being able to target us with nuclear weapons, but also that the Trump administration seems sort of cavalier about launching a preemptive nuclear war, which is also a disastrous scenario. It seems to me the only workable plan is to try to talk to the North Korean government, and as terrible as they are, to establish some lines of communication, because what they want is respect and membership in the world community, and that's the only leverage that we have.
Do you lose sleep over North Korea, Jonathan?
I don't lose sleep over it, mainly because I'm not on the West Coast. I say that jokingly.
Right.
We should all be concerned about North Korea. I don't think that we have a basic moral authority to say another country shouldn't have a nuclear weapon. I think what we have is a moral authority derived from the years and years that we've had nuclear weapons and have not used them since the first uses in Japan. But also, much more importantly, a might makes right authority. That is to say, we have the power to encourage them or force them to not develop nuclear weapons, or at least try to do that. And, of course, they want to develop nuclear weapons so that we have to take them more seriously in the future and so that it's harder for us to lay sanctions on them. So that's where the battleground is. This is about realpolitik, not about, you know, sort of greater questions of morality.
Well, we're darn out of time. We never got to Mexico, but have a great time with your family in Mexico.
Yeah,
that sounds terrific. And thank you both so much. I've loved talking to you over the years. I think you have fine political minds, and it's been very engaging. Thank you.
Well, it's great to hear you,
Kathleen.
We'll miss you.
Yeah, thanks. I'll miss you, too. I'll miss doing this All Things Political, and I hope that it will be continued in some form in the months and years ahead. Our thanks very much to Ruth Conniff, editor of the Progressive magazine, Jonathan Allen, who's now a columnist for Roll Call, and he is author of Shattered: Inside Hillary Clinton's Doomed Campaign. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee.